Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
I want to welcome everyone to episode number 18 of Matt Memories from Madison Square Garden, a 50-year retrospective, the early years of the WWWF, the WWF, and the WWE. Madison Square Garden, the mecca of professional wrestling, a building that every wrestler wanted to wrestle in. We record one show a month to coincide with the 50th anniversary of a wrestling house show at Madison Square Garden. And to help us look back at all these shows, a man who went to every wrestling house show at Madison Square Garden for 5 years straight, starting in August 30th, 1971, Mr. Baseball himself, John Arizzi. John, how are you?
Thank you for that Mr. Baseball introduction. I sometimes feel like Mr. Baseball, even though this is a wrestling podcast, because we're gearing up for the new season of the Gibby Show. So that'll be launching again by the end of this month. So we're excited about that. And of course, I'll be following the Mets every single day. But we are an adult today, aren't we? Episode 18. So we are in 18, seems like 18 years in instead of 18 episodes. But that's what we do. We're here to review what happened 50 years ago. And this is a big one.
It is pretty amazing. And one of the reasons I called you Mr. Baseball, because you're such a big baseball fan. You watch every Met game. I'm surprised you don't do a Met podcast.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that I was actually talking about with my nephew, because he's such a big Met fan myself. And now that I have the Gibby audience, the baseball fans, and we're growing the audience here, even in the United States, 95% of our audience right now is from Canada. We're the number one baseball podcast up there. But that may be something that down the road I look to explore, because I would love nothing better than to do a baseball podcast that people actually listen to. And you know, now that I'm with John Gibbons, who is iconic and our audience is huge, maybe there's a way within the next season, not this year, but maybe next year, that I could do a Mets podcast with my nephew, who would probably love to do that with me.
That's very, very cool. That's very cool. And also, we also want to thank all our Patreons for helping us make this podcast possible. Patreon.com/John Arizzi. Not only do you get to listen to this podcast, but John Arizzi's Pro Wrestling Spotlight, 8mm film, personal photos from 50 years ago. You get so much on Patreon.com/John Arizzi. John, what have you added to Patreon recently?
Well, we add stuff every Sunday. So I actually found a really rare clip. It was from 1993, WCW. It was Bill Watts' last week in control. Jim Cornette invades WCW. And it was a great interview with Gordon Solie and Cactus Jack. So I found that, and I put that up for everybody this week. In addition to another photo set, the 8mm film from the last Garden show with King Curtis against Pedro Morales, that went over pretty big. The patrons get content every Sunday, and they get not only this podcast early, but they also get the Pro Wrestling Spotlight podcast 5 days early. They get the video version of the Pro Wrestling Spotlight podcast 5 days early, and they get all of the unedited original radio broadcasts of the Pro Wrestling Spotlight. So right now we're closing in on this. When we tape this week, it'll be officially episodes number 199 and episodes 200 of the program. During this time period, we had two shows. We had Pro Wrestling This Week, which ran on WNYG in the morning on Saturday, and then the evening show, we're back at WEVD. And so those shows are all up there. You have 200 shows from April 9th, 1989, to the show that we're taping this week, which was March 13th, 1993. And what we're doing with the podcast now, every week we have guests. We just had Conan on reviewing his first show appearance ever on Pro Wrestling Spotlight. And that was the day he met Terry Funk for the first time via the telephone, and Funk and Conan meeting each other, and then Conan reviewing it and not hitting, you know, not doesn't even remember. And then Honky Tonk Man calls in unexpectedly, and then Terry Funk shoots on him and calls him a moron. So not only that, but we have, you know, other guests that have been on every week, Eric Bischoff, Mark Madden. We've had just every week now is a different guest. $5 a month gets you in the door. There are other levels depending on how much content you want. So just go to patreon.com/John Arizzi, as my friend Tim says, and you can experience and relive the history with us on patreon.com.
Join the family, join the fun, patreon.com/John Arizzi. Help keep the lights on and help us to continue to bring you this podcast free of charge. Patreon.com/John Arizzi. John, I've been waiting for this card for a long time. The eighth wonder of the world, Andre the Giant, first appearance at Madison Square Garden. I'm so excited for this. Monday night, March 26, 1973, 22,136, a sellout, 8:30 bell time. Little note here, John, Richie told me that in Scott Teal's book, Wrestling at the Garden, has an attendance of 19,000. Do you remember, was this a sellout crowd or wasn't it?
This was a absolute sellout. It was an absolute sellout. So that book, which for the most part is accurate, and it's just our Bible, so to speak, when we do this. But for that particular show, March 26, 1973, which was a life-changing show for me, the attendance, 22,098, was the more believable. Oh, I'm sorry. I was reading that wrong. 22,136. 22,098 was the last show in February. So, yeah, but this show, Tim, was life-changing for me. This was the show where I actually went backstage for the first time and met Fred Blassie face-to-face for the first time. Fred had written me a letter as I was in the middle of running his fan club at this point, and I'd gotten a letter from Fred saying that he was going to be at this show and he'd love to see me there.
Okay, let's hold it there. A little tease for the rest of the show, as they call it. Let's hold it there. I want to just go back a little quick. Do you remember any build-up on TV since Andre's first appearance, Blassie's coming back to the Garden? Do you remember any build-up for the show?
Of course. I mean, Blassie was just annihilating opponents week after week. The X was on TV. He was biting the heads. Freddie was doing these TV tapings, and so he'd win the first one, he'd win the second one, and then they announced that he was going to fight Pedro Morales on TV, and Blassie comes out with Captain Lou Albano with his arm in a sling. And he said he couldn't wrestle Morales that night. His arm, you know, was messed up. Then Morales comes out, and then Blassie attacks him, bites him. And that was a buildup for that main event, which was the main event at the Garden. For Andre, they were announcing that it would be the first appearance by Andre the Giant, which was kind of confusing because Andre had not used that name before. He was using the Giant Gene Ferry, the Giant Rusamoff, but he was not going under the moniker of Andre the Giant. So that was kind of like we knew who it was, and we couldn't understand why the name was changed.
Back in the day, Vince Sr., did he own the name or did he just give him the name?
He gave him the name. He just thought he could be billed better as Andre the Giant. And then that name stuck. And then McMahon, shortly thereafter, became the exclusive agent for Andre. He would handle Andre's schedule and he would book Andre around the country. So that was all handled from Vince McMahon's office after this first appearance at the Garden.
And that is really important because if you know anything about Andre the Giant, he's similar to the women wrestlers. You can't have him in every month. So the booking is so important. And he was booking him all over the country. I remember him down in Mid-South. I remember him in Memphis territories. I remember him in World Class. They put him on his own little junket going around. And the stories I heard, I actually covered the Andre the Giant documentary for HBO. And I was talking to Jimmy Hart about that. And he was telling me how long he came into town for. And they had him every night being in a different place, and they had to get him a driver and put him out places and take care of him. So he was always in demand, but he wasn't in demand in the same spot all the time because you couldn't have him there all the time or he loses that magic.
Very true. He was an attraction. When he would come to a town, you knew it was going to sell out because he was this attraction. For the Garden, this first appearance, he came back that year. This was his first show, but he eventually did 4 shows that year at the Garden. He brought the crowd in. He faced Tanaka. There was another singles match. Then he did a tag team match in November. And everyone got to know him as Andre the Giant after this.
Would Andre the Giant be as popular if it wasn't for Vince McMahon Sr.? Maybe, maybe not, because the booking was an important part of his style because, like you said, he's an attraction. He could not be at the same spot all the time. So you have to move him around, constantly moving him around. And Did Andre want to take care of that? No, Vince Sr. took care of it for him and made people happy. You know, they probably said to him, hey, you know, someone made a call from Florida. Hey, we can use Andre this weekend. We're doing a big show. Or, yeah, fantastic. We'll get him down there. So he's keeping people happy, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And Andre became a massive star after this Garden debut. And I think it was mainly because it was the media capital of the world, first of all, even though he didn't get a lot of mainstream media at that time. But all the major wrestling magazines were there at ringside shooting pictures. And for many of them, you know, this was it. This was like the coverage that Andre received at the national newsstand magazines because he was now with McMahon and McMahon was booking him and the shows in Philadelphia and Boston at the Garden, the 4 appearances he made in 73 and then in 74 and then working a deal out with Mike LaBelle in Los Angeles and sending Andre there to win the Battle Royal 2 years in a row in 74 and 75. Andre became this massive star. He was on his way, but maybe it happened quicker because McMahon booked him at the Garden and then started booking him after that. I think Andre's star rose quicker because of his affiliation with McMahon.
And McMahon used him as an attraction all over the country. I'm sure some of these promoters wouldn't know what to do with him. They probably use him all the time. And McMahon knew you don't get him all the time because if you get him all the time, you're going to ruin the specialness of him.
Yeah, and then, you know, of course, he became a huge attraction over in Japan. His life changed in 1973, where he became this huge attraction in pro wrestling, where he'd been prominently wrestling just in Canada, up in that territory, and really not hitting the major cities in the United States up until this point.
Well, let's go to Andre's first appearance at the Garden. It is a Monday night, March 26, 1973. First match, El Olimpico defeated Joe Turco in 8 minutes, 14 seconds.
El Olimpico and Joe Turco, we have a little story about him, obviously, but my mind is racing back 50 years. Because of the pivotal moment that this was, I had went to the dressing room entrance. I had presented the letter, and I probably did that before the show started because I was all excited. My concentration level was probably not even there in the beginning of this show. And I was able to pull the letter that I got from Freddie here. And of course, you can't see it. This is audio only, but Timmy, you could take a look at that. And there
Very
it is.
Nice.
This letter was written on March 8th, 1973, and I'll read it.
Yeah.
It was on stationery from the Madison Motor Inn in Boston. That's it was adjacent to the Boston Garden. That's where Fred stayed when he was up in the Northeast area. And then he eventually moved to Hartsdale, New York. But in this letter, when I got it in the mail, I was just like, holy smokes. And it read, Dear John, I guess by now you know that I'm back here on the East Coast. Jeff, meaning Jeff Walton, forwarded your second issue of King of Men. All I could say is you're doing a great job. Plus, I'm happy to have you as the president of the Fred Blassie Fan Club. I know it is a time-consuming job, along with not much reward. As you know, I was elected and voted as the Wrestler of the Year in 1972, but as of yet, none of the magazines have carried the story, and it was in October 1972 in Santa Monica. Well, I guess that's all for now. I hope this is the pivotal line. I hope to see you at MSG March 26. Keep up the great work. Sincerely, Fred Blassie. This was my ticket. Whether or not the security guard would even think it's real, the fact he took it and showed Blassie, and then I was told to come back after, you know, after the show started. And so that's why my concentration level, that's why we digress here. The concentration level for El Olimpico against Joe Turco was certainly not there.
Well, we can actually just talk about like El Olimpico. We would talk about all the masked wrestlers had to wear an open face mask back in the day.
Yeah.
And then Mil Máscaras came in, and you would think it would change, but it only changed for Máscaras because El Olimpico, again, had the open face mask at this match.
Unless it was a Mil Máscaras thing saying, because he was pretty tough to work with, you know, I don't want anyone else wearing mask.
Oh, I never thought of that, that he kept it that way.
Maybe. That's only my speculation.
I love that.
It eventually did change down the road, but in those initial years, it was like, even though Máscaras was on a card and El Olimpico or some others that, like the spoiler, they weren't allowed. Who knows who the edit came from?
Interesting.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
And Joe Turco, who was your former tag team partner, I wanted to talk about that TV taping. I know it's coming up in years from now, but since we are talking about Turco, before your TV taping, do you talk over the match with Turco?
Well, I remember it like it was yesterday because I did such a piss poor job in the first match against Dusty Rhodes. You know, I showed everybody on that taping that I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I was a little green, you know, somebody with no training would look green, and I had no training. So I remember specifically, I was on the second taping and the third taping. You know, they pulled me off the third taping. I was supposed to wrestle Bob Backlund, but after the tag team match, they said I was done. So when we're going over the card, because it's Gorilla Monsoon booking, and then he called me and Turco and Maivia and Strongbow, and all was told was like, all right, this is gonna go 8 minutes, because it was an eight minute. He goes, but you look at me, you stay out of the ring the whole time. Joe, he stays out of the ring the entire time till the end, and then you tag him in, and then we go to the finish. So I wasn't even allowed in the ring, and the whole match was really basically Joe trying to tag me into the ring, and Strongbow, or they put him in a headlock, you get 2 inches from me, and then, you know, they pull him back, and it was just a comedy match for what it was. But Turco was the same thing, because you just follow my lead, you stay, you know, stay out till you're supposed to come in. And he was nice and polite, but, you know, they all knew this guy is not good, so keep him out the ring. And, you know, and when I did finally get that tag, and they vaulted me in from over the top rope, and then Strongbow picked me up and threw me into the corner where Peter Maivia gave me a headbutt, and then I fell back, and Strongbow pinned me 1-2-3, and it was over. It was that quick.
It was quick, but in one night, John, you wrestled three WWE Hall of Famers.
Yeah, those three gentlemen made the Hall of Fame. Dusty, Maivia, Strongbow, and of course Maivia and his legacy, you know, he's The Rock's grandfather, man.
Yeah. Even though it wasn't a great night as in wins and losses, because it did, we'll talk about that in the future, how it did affect your career.
I was happy not to wrestle Backlund too. I was that they pulled me, because I was like, this guy who stretched my ass,
definitely,
that I would have been taught a lesson.
Good thing you didn't. But that would have been 4 Hall of Famers in one night. But, you know, we digress.
Yeah, wouldn't that be something?
That would have been great.
And my pay would have probably went up, too.
Yeah, another 15. How much did you get paid for that, by the way?
$50 a match. So I got $90, because there was a $10 fee to get your license.
All right. Look at it. Look at you. You made money. You wrestled Hall of Famers. You had a good night. Yeah, back then, you probably didn't think as much. But now, you look back.
I took the fucking bus home. The Greyhound. And I had a concussed or whatever. I had a splitting headache. I was a little incoherent. And the fact that I had to have my friends drop me off in Philadelphia in the middle of the night at a bus station to get back to New York and then take the train back. It was like it was a clusterfuck.
What time did you finally get home?
Probably, as my old neighbors used to say, the butt crack of dawn.
All right. We'll digress. Well, let's digress. Match number 2, Tony Garea defeated Frank Valois in 10 minutes, 15 seconds.
Yeah, Frank Valois, this was Andre's handler at the time out of Canada. So anytime Andre was appearing, Frank Valois, at least in the first year, he would take Andre and, you know, he'd be his handler, so to speak. And Frank was a veteran. He actually was also known as the Red Mask. His first Madison Square Garden appearance took place August 15th, 1959, and he was pinned by Arnold Golden Boy Skolin, 10 minutes, 9 seconds back then. And Skolin, as everybody knows, managed both Bruno Sammartino, and Bobby Backlund in their championship years.
Wow. It's amazing. You find out these little details. Probably people watching the match never knew that that was Andre's handler.
Exactly.
And before we go to the next match, little Johnny Arizzi, president of the Fred Blassie fan club, went backstage to interview Mr. Blassie himself. And this is how big this is. You are going from, on this night, you're going from being a fan, being somebody, you know, you're the president of the Fred Blassie fan club, to coming into the inner circle. Even though you're not in a lot, you actually get to go backstage and are treated not like a fan, but as a reporter.
Yeah, I was very, very nervous. So at the designated time, you know, I waited a couple of matches and I get to the dressing room entrance, and before you know it, I'm being summoned in. And Blassie was on his way. I never forget, because he was peeking out of the dressing room door and he saw me and he waved. And I'm there and there's like Vince McMahon Sr. and there's reporters and there's wrestlers. Mr. Fuji I saw walking around, Victor Rivera. And it was just kind of like it was in the surreal atmosphere. So Fred came out a few minutes later and he's like, I got to do this interview first before I could talk to you. And he and Albano were being interviewed by Bill Apter and George Napolitano, and they were cutting a promo and all of this. And then finally, I'm just there in awe looking at this guy that was kind of my hero. And I was getting more nervous as each second ticked away, because I'm like, you know, I have my list of questions I was going to ask him. And my friend Frank was there with the camera. So when he finished with Apter and Napolitano, then we got a chance to spend some time together. And we had, you know, some chit chat. You had my little tape recorder with me and I asked him the questions. And this is a sad story. The cassette tape of that original interview snapped. The tape broke.
We can fix it.
Yeah, how could you fix that?
What you do is we're going to take it apart and we get to
Yeah, but what
area.
If it's glued together and not screwed together?
That's a great question. I remember fixing them before, and you get to play it once.
Yeah, that's all I need to do is digitize it. I just need to play it once. That's what I was trying to do. And it was just like when I rewound it, it just snapped.
Okay, so one area has nothing on it and the other one has everything on it. It didn't like snap in the middle.
Yep.
All right, check into it. I think we can fix this. I know I've done it before, but usually it's in the middle. And what you do is you know, you do the little really thing on both sides. You pull it apart. You put a cut in it.
Yeah, it's in the shell, I guess. It's not like you can't even pick the tape.
Yeah.
Because I would have done a rudimentary edit with a little scotch tape or a little glue. But anyway, I do remember the interview like it was yesterday. I was very nervous. There was like five or six questions which were not even like deep conversational, like what was your favorite match, Fred, and like these questions that a kid would ask somebody. And then when that was over, you know, we got through that okay, and then we were able to take some pictures together of me and Blassie and then Frank Favalli and Blassie, and him holding up a copy of the newsletter. And that was it. It's, you know, because then he had to get ready because he was going to be wrestling Pedro Morales. And then I got whisked back out into my seats, and I was in heaven. It was hard to even concentrate on the show because I was just kind of like, I can't believe that happened. But that was the beginning for me.
Yeah, and you were treated differently from then on in, because now you're part of the inner circle.
I don't know if I was treated differently. Let's put it that
way.
I was still a 15-year-old kid, right? But the thing was, is like every time Fred was there, I'd get backstage, which was kind of cool.
That is cool, but then that's how you got to know Bill Apter and Jordan Napolitano on a different level, not on like a fan level.
Yeah, that was, you know, getting to know them, and I was just a fan. I wasn't even anyone who had any pictures published except for that one shot of Lou Albano and WrestleMania of You in November 72. But I mean, it really was a catalyst for me because it gave me hope that maybe I can do something more in the business. And the notoriety I got with the Blassie Fan Club and then winning Fan Club of the Year in 74, winning the Bill Apter Fan Club of the Year award for 74, the best monthly fan bulletin, and then started taking pictures. So this was the catalyst for me. This was, if it wasn't for the Blassie Fan Club and meeting Fred and being able to kind of see that anything is possible, that this was one of the pivotal moments of my entire life.
Monday, March 26th, 1973, a double pivotal moment for you and for Andre.
Yes, it was a pivotal moment for both of us.
Yes.
Although he fared a little bit better in making money in the wrestling business than I did.
A little tiny bit. Let's go on to match number three. I don't know if you saw this one or not, John, but Mad Dog Vachon and Butcher Vachon defeated Don Curtis and Louis Tellez in 12 minutes, 9 seconds.
Yeah, I don't remember it because I was in the back.
Yeah. So... there you go. Anything you want to mention about these guys?
Don Curtis was a really famous wrestler. It was big time in New York for a while. He was also known as Don Bettelman. He debuted in 1951, retired in 1981. He was trained by Lou Fez. His first Madison Square Garden appearance was on October the 20th, 1958, when he teamed with Mark Lewin. And that was a famous tag team. Lewin and Curtis were a very historic tag team. And Louis Tellez, also known as Joe Fargo or Joe Gordon, he was a little short in stature, 5'9". He was known as the Strutting Blonde from France. It was his first Madison Square Garden appearance, and he helped train Mad Dog Vachon.
Everything's connected. Let's go to match number four. Victor Rivera fought the Great Goliath to a 20-minute draw. John, this had to be the best match of the card. Both wrestlers from Mike and Gene LaBelle in Los Angeles territory.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it was the best match on the card, although I don't remember it because I didn't see it because I was in the dressing room still. But Goliath coming in from the Los Angeles territory was a great worker. Of course, his tag team partner with Black Ordman. They'd held the tag team championships 18 times out in L.A. And Victor Rivera, one of the fan favorites. So, I'm sure that they both agreed that either one of them was going to do the favor or the job that night. And that's why it went to a 20-minute draw. And it was probably an exciting match, although I don't remember it.
Because?
I was hanging out with Blassie.
There you go. Let's go on to match number five. One half of the WWF Tag Team Champions, Mr. Fuji, defeated Sonny King in 7 minutes, 26 seconds.
Yeah, this one, I do remember coming back to the seats and getting ready for that main event. I was there suited up with my camera, and I think I shot a little 8mm film of this particular match. Fuji, better known for his ribs that he pulled on the wrestlers more than his wrestling, and Mr. Fuji was not the very best wrestler or not the very best wrestling manager, although he was a tag team champion. But Fuji was well-liked and kept being brought back and used by the McMahons. He basically spent most of his career there in the WWF, before WWE. Sonny King had some great matches in other territories, but he wasn't really, he just wasn't over. He had a little run there with Strongbow as a tag team champions. Was it a horrible match? It probably was.
I don't know why they booked something like this with both of these guys being better off in tag teams.
Yeah, I mean, it was just kind of a filler match. I mean, you had some exciting stuff happening. He had the big stars coming up, but it was a filler. It was nothing more than a filler.
Let's go to the match you've been waiting for a long time, John. Match number six, the WWF World Champion, Pedro Morales, defeated your guy, Classy Freddie Blassie, in 8 minutes, 20 seconds when referee Danny Bartfield stopped the match, saying the challenger was unable to continue due to the excess of blood. Please explain this to me, John.
Well, there wasn't a lot of blood, let's put it that way. I mean, I don't know, for me, even though I knew wrestling at that time was a work, I had known because of the 1972 Bruno versus Pedro match, I knew it was not on the up and up. I had my 8mm camera out and I filmed it. I was kind of like wanting to suspend my disbelief and believe it was real. And I wanted Blassie to beat Morales, although that was never going to happen. And here's the thing about Fred, because Freddie was never really scarred up. And he's one of those wrestlers that you heard rumors about that maybe he didn't blade a lot. And he used some type of substance to create the illusion of blood on his forehead. And his hair was so like white and blonde that any little bit of blood would make his hair turn color. So in this particular match, it was a great brawl. Blassie used the string from his tights, like that you tie your bathing suit together with that little rope inside. He tore it out. He wrapped it around Morales' throat, was choking him. And then a fan threw one of these flash cubes into the ring, these little square flash cubes. He picked that up, gouged Morales' eyes with it, and then started biting him. And then Pedro would come back, and Blassie would bite him, and Blassie would have him down. And then finally, Morales threw Blassie out of the ring onto the ring apron, not a full bump to the floor. Blassie was still a little older. Morales took great bumps, but Freddie wouldn't be able to do that. So on the ring apron, Morales picks him up and rams his head into the iron post and the unprotected part of the turnbuckle. And in my film, you see Blassie putting something on his forehead, and it didn't look like a, you know, like a gig, like he was gigging himself with a razor, but it looked like he was squeezing something. And then Morales gets him in the ring, and Morales starts throwing his patented left hooks, and Bartfield kept looking at Blassie, but there was not a massive amount of blood. There was a spot. So the blood wasn't like flowing. It just kind of colored his forehead and the top of his hair. When Bartfield stepped in and deemed him unable to continue, of course, the fans were going crazy. They loved it. But I was like, this sucks. Even though the match was very exciting, this sucks. He's not even bleeding. Why did they stop it? You know, but it was all a work, obviously. And I'm like caught up in the moment. And there was no rematch after that. I mean, it was one and done for Fred in the main event against Morales. So typically, if you're going to lose by blood, you're going to come back the next match, Texas death, whatever the stip would be, stipulation, and then you get the pinfall. But Blassie, one and done, because they moved on right after that to the next show, which we'll cover in April, which was Don Leo Jonathan. But I was disappointed, but I was happy because of meeting Fred and capturing it. I used to bring two or three rolls of this film. I mean, they're all 3.5 minutes. I might have had three rolls here. I specifically concentrated on the Blassie match, which I gave a full roll to, 3.5 minutes, and then the Andre match that we're going to talk about. But getting to see this match, when I got that film back from Photomat back then on Long Island, and I put it on the projector and I saw this for the first time, I was so happy with the way I filmed it, even though I was disappointed, because to this day, I mean, I look at it and I'm like, this is incredible just to even have it, you know? But I was disappointed with it, but I knew, you know, unfortunately Blassie wasn't going to win, but he was still in the territory, so I'd get a chance to see him again on the next show.
And let's go on to match number 7. Gorilla Monsoon fought the other half of the WWF Tag Team Champions, Professor Toru Tanaka, to a 20-minute time limit draw.
Yeah, I don't remember very much about that match, Tim. I probably was in my seat, just kind of spent from the match before and the excitement that already had ensued. But yeah, 20-minute draw, Monsoon and Tanaka. Monsoon, of course, also known as Robert Morella, Bob Morella. He debuted in 1958. Retired in 1977, trained by Stu Hart, his first Madison Square Garden appearance, August 2nd, 1963, with a win over Carl Steef, a.k.a. Clyde Stevens, in 3 minutes 58 seconds back then. And before we talk a little bit about Tanaka, Monsoon, for me, was one of those guys that early on, because they said he was from Manchuria. When I first started wrestling, it was like this big giant gorilla from Manchuria with this big beard. He didn't speak English. He was with, I believe, Wild Red Barry at the time. And he was this incredible heel that was unbeatable. You know, always thought that he had the skills and he was strong enough to beat Bruno. And another little side note, I mean, it was Monsoon versus San Martino in February of 67 that I actually tried to go to my first show and were turned away at the door because of that ban. You had to be 14 to get in. And I had no idea about that. And that ban of being 14 or older to get in was stemmed from a big riot that took place at Madison Square Garden years earlier when they had this riot that police officers, 300 chairs were damaged. It was like this big brouhaha. And after that, it was like kids are not allowed to see wrestling anymore. So during that time period, I was 10 years old in 67, had no idea that this ban took place. My dad convinced him to take me to the Garden, Monsoon versus San Martino, and I wasn't allowed in. And just cried my little eyes out on the way back to Long Island from Manhattan. My father was like, what a waste of time, you know? So anyway, I digress. But anyway, Professor Tanaka, He went to high school in Hawaii with Harry Fujiwara, a.k.a. Mr. Fuji. Oh. And in 1985, Taro Tanaka was also in Pee-wee Herman's Big Adventure, which was one of my favorite movies.
Love it. Love it. Hey, let's go on to the big match of the night, match number eight. Look at that. Match number eight, the eighth wonder of the world. Andre the Giant defeated Buddy Wolf in 7 minutes, 46 seconds. Andre's Madison Square Garden debut. Tell me all about it, John.
Well, I mean, it's captured on film, and it was Buddy Wolf against Andre the Giant. And it was funny because there was no music back then. And all you could see was this head. I mean, as he's walking out of the dressing room when I'm filming it, you just see this massive afro, so to speak, this big hair and this big guy, this gigantic individual walking down the aisle and entering the ring. And when he finally got into the ring, it was like, holy smokes. Look at the size of this dude. He had weight on him and he was tall, but the moves that he was able to do against Buddy Wolf, he had these bolo punches, which were so incredible. And it was more or less like Buddy Wolf was trying to do anything to take an advantage of him. And there was not one spot that Buddy was getting any of it. It was Andre lifting him up and putting him on the top turnbuckle and then shaking his finger at him. Be careful with me, you know, boss. And then Buddy took some great bumps for him, really incredible bumps. And the way he defeated him is he had Buddy's leg up and he fell on it, and then he did a big splash onto him, and he got the 1-2-3, and the fans went nuts. And it was like, can't believe what we just saw. Andre the Giant, it was incredible. And of course, we have a little background information on this guy. I mean, Andre Rene Rusamoff, Jean Fari, and the Giant Machine. These are all names that he used. He was born in 1946 and died 30 years ago at 46 in 1993. And we have such an incredible episode about Andre that if you go back to the archives of the Pro Wrestling Spotlight podcast and radio show, I would invite you to hear some really cool stories about that. We had Chris Owens, who was the foremost Andre historian, and Jackie Bernard McCauley, who lived on the farm and took care of the farm in North Carolina with him. They appeared on our podcast and they had some great Andre stories. But Andre made his debut in Japan, ironically, in 1970. He relocated to North America in 71 to Canada. He became a success there, as we talked about. And just 2 days before his appearance in Madison Square Garden, Andre made his first appearance for the WWF in Philadelphia in a handicap, and he defeated Frank Valois, his handler, and Bull Vincente Pomenti. Valois was also a successful wrestler around the Montreal, Canada area. He was noted for training and managing Andre in the early years of his career. And Vince Sr. took over Andre's booking, as we mentioned, 1973 to the early 80s. Vince Sr. and Jr. served as Andre's booking agent exclusively. And Vince Sr. understood that Andre was a special attraction, and a stay in any territory was usually 30 days or less, so the fans wouldn't get tired of him. You know, he was treated like a world champion with a string of one-night stands. By the early 80s, he certainly was no longer the special attraction that he was for many years, and became a mainstay in the WWF and turned heel, managed by Bobby the Brain Heenan. And of course, in 1993, WrestleMania number 3 was the largest indoor attendance ever for a wrestling show, Andre versus Hulk Hogan, and it was a no-brainer who was going to win. Andre at this time couldn't really support his own weight, and it's kind of interesting that on the A&E Rivals show, they just had the story of Andre and Hulk Hogan as their feud. And although Hogan says he didn't know he was going to win or lose at WrestleMania 3 till he got into the ring because Andre wouldn't tell him, I think that's a bunch of BS, personally. But I think that Andre in that match might have called the spots and gave Hogan the okay to slam him. And that's when the pin took place, 1-2-3. And a little Andre fun fact, since he couldn't easily go shopping due to his size, he was known to spend hours and hours watching QVC, where Andre made frequent purchases.
It's just amazing how much, you know, this one night would change his life. If he wasn't put over so much in this match, maybe Vince wouldn't have, taken him under his wing and been his manager or been his agent.
Yeah, the fan reaction was certainly there. And I do remember there was an illustration like the Andre the Giant is here. And that was a special, I believe it might have even been an insert in the program that night that Andre the Giant was there. And I wish I had my copy of it. But it was a special night. And the way the fans reacted to him, that kind of reinforced what McMahon was thinking, that this guy's going to be huge in the wrestling business for years to come.
And he was. The last match of the night, Chief Jay Strongbow fought Moondog Maine to a curfew draw. Is this unusual, John, that a curfew draw be with somebody who went for the title last month against Morales?
Yeah, no, there's no rhyme or reason, Tim. I really, this was just the way it was put together. It was the last match on the show, and it was going to be a draw. So he wasn't really going to get hurt. And Strongbow was a big star, too. But him putting, you know, there was so much going on that show. And obviously the focal points were Andre's debut and Blassie Morales. This was just kind of a way for you to say, all right, it's time to go home. And I don't think I stayed there for the duration of that particular match. It was time to catch the train. But, you know, Chief Jay Strongbow, Luke Joseph Scarpa, his real name, born in Nutley, New Jersey, trained by Chief Don Eagle, also known as Carl Donald Bell from Canada. Strongbow's debut was in the WWWF in 1970 at the age of 42.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
He was an old-timer, man.
When I saw him late in the 70s win the tag team title. He was almost 50, I guess.
Yeah. He hung around for a while. He was a journeyman, and he wrestled for a while. I mean, someone just sent me some pictures of a photo album. Someone reached out to me on Instagram. This woman used to go to all the indie shows in Jersey, and there was a photo album with autographed pictures and guys backstage, and Joe Scarpa was in that photo album that I saw the pictures of. And yeah, I mean, he was around for a while, but he didn't really become successful until they changed him into Chief Jay Strongbow, and he became one of the biggest babyface superstars in the Northeast for many, many, many years.
Wow.
And, you know, you look at Maine, you know, if you want to see Moondog Maine eat glass, it's on YouTube. Under Lonnie Moondog Maine. I mean, he used to eat light bulbs. He'd eat live goldfish on TV during promos. While Albano was the mouthpiece, Lonnie Maine was eating glass and chewing on goldfish. Interesting cat, man.
Very interesting. John, how would you rate this card back from March 1973?
I'd have to give it a, you know, two thumbs up, obviously, and pivotal for me. Changed my life, you know, getting to see Andre the Giant make his debut. Changed Andre's life. Freddie Blassie, Pedro Morales, one of the most exciting crowd intensity to crowd that night. It was very, very memorable. And the fact that I have footage of it, of those two matches in particular, it'll live forever for me.
And we're going to add some of this to the Patreon.
I am going to. I mean, the Andre stuff, I put little clips here and there. I may put a few seconds of footage on that one and the Morales Blassie. I put together a little for patrons that it's up there now, and it's called Matt Memories. It was the night I met Freddie Blassie. So I will repost that for all the new patrons that have joined. You could hear the entire story with visuals, and there was a clip of that interview I did with Freddie on that one. I'll put that up for patrons for this episode.
And how about this? What if you make a copy of that letter?
Yes, I will scan the letter.
I cannot even imagine, like, Fred Blassie sitting back in a motel in Boston writing little Johnny Arizzi and thanking him for being the president of his fan club. That's pretty cool.
First one, and then I get another letter, May of 73. Then there's another letter. This one got a little ripped up. I have to, it's scotch tape, but that's from July 73. I got postcards that Freddie used to write me from Japan. And this is where he kind of indicated to me that he was going to be back in the WWWF for an extended stay, which means he was turning into a wrestling manager. He knew back in July of 73 that he was coming in. He didn't spill the beans to me, but I'll just finish this letter off and then we'll finish the podcast. It's like July 19th, 1973. Hey, John, happy to hear about the fan club doing so well, but you are the one that deserves all the credit. Because I used to write him back at the Madison Hotel and tell him the progress of the show and thanking him for his time and all that. But he said, you're the one that deserves the credit. I will be happy to see you at the Garden July 23rd. Hope there was a mix-up, I guess, in the June show. Hope there won't be a mix-up as last time. I couldn't get in one of these times now that this letter is refreshing my memory. And after the Garden show, I will be returning to California for a stay of 8 weeks. Then I'll go to Japan for 2 months. And after that, I will be returning to the East Coast for a very lengthy stay. Be sure to give Donna my love, my sister, because we had met Freddie at a little indie show, the Roll-A-Rama in Brooklyn in Bensonhurst. And my sister got a chance to say hello to Freddie Blassie there. And so he never forgot her in any conversation I ever had whole letter. He would always say hello to Donna for me. So what a great guy. But this was the tip off that he was coming in to be a, I didn't know he was going to be a manager until he, you know, debuted with Nikolai Volkov as his first protege. Interesting stuff today.
I can't wait to see that all on the Patreon. Join the community, join the fun, patreon.com/John Arizzi. Our next match, Madison Square Garden, April 30th, 1973, headlined by Don Leo Jonathan getting his crack at Pedro's title, and Austin Idol makes his first appearance at Madison Square Garden.
Yes, as under Iron Mike McCord.
Iron Mike McCord. Oh, wow. It's great to look back and see how some of these guys started. Once again, we want to take a shout out to Scott Teal and Crowbar Press for his book, Wrestling at the Garden.
Yeah, the Bible that we have, that battle for New York, work, shoots, and double crosses, Scott Teal. I love the book. You should get a copy of it. Go to crowbarpress.com for that.
Anything else, John?
Tim, I appreciate your time, as I always do, my friend. You do a great job bringing these memories out of me and just kind of keeping this history alive, man. We're keeping the history alive.
What did Freddie Blassie say to you? It's all you, John. It's all you. What did he say?
I deserve all the credit.
John, yeah. You deserve all the credit. For John Arizzi and Richie Garcia, I'm Tim Poutre. We'll see you next time.